Okay, well, since I was last giving a talk here a week ago, I've been conducting marriages, giving talks. I've been to Thailand and back. I live a very busy life. Anyone who says, "Oh, if you want to have a peaceful life, become a monk." But even though I travel very much and do many things, but still, I was talking to one of the monks in Thailand. He said, "How come that you do so much but you can still meditate so well?" And it's always the case that because of the training in Buddhism, especially as monks and nuns, we do actually learn how, if I ever go to Thailand, I don't take this temple with me. You're not allowed to carry a temple on the aircraft, which means that I don't carry all those burdens with me. You let them go in the past. When I come back here, I don't bring Thailand back with me, which means that whatever you do, you just do this one thing at a time. You do it really, really well, and you don't allow these things to keep accumulating in your brain and worrying about them and planning about them and doing such things. And so, even you can work very hard, but you can stop very quickly. It is true that sometimes the amount of work which I do is like, I feel sometimes like I'm a big truck, like one of these big road trains, but I've got the incredibly powerful brakes. Even though you're going very fast, you can stop very quickly. And of course, stopping is important. You can't fill up for gas when you're on the move. So you have to stop to get a recharge of gas. It's the same way that we learn through our power of meditation, learn how to stop so you can recharge your energies. But the reason I was over in Thailand, I only just returned at 4 p.m. this afternoon, was for having a meeting at the memorial service for my teacher Ajahn Chah. And because hanging out with all your old mates, these are all my old monk mates, and talking about old times and just doing ceremonies for your teacher, it brought back all these wonderful old memories of the life, with a monk like Ajahn Chah. And that's going to be roughly the talk this evening about some of the wonderful, inspiring things which meant that Buddhism was taken out of the books and put into real life, and it was very impressive. Now, my own story, I was already a Buddhist when I was 16, reading books. And of course, I listened to many talks. I already had some meditation experience, but it was a real eye-opener, actually, to go to a place where what you read in the books was actually being lived. And that made all these teachings which you hear here just so alive and vital. Just the simple things of just kindness and compassion. It's amazing how many Buddhists aren't compassionate, except in public when they're supposed to be behaving themselves. They're always compassionate when they come to the temple, but I don't know what they do to their partners when they get back home. Even before they get back home, someone cuts in front of them at the lights, and you already lost it. But one of the great things which I saw over there was actually people were living this. Actually, that when this morning, just in the airport in Singapore, the lady who fed me some breakfast, she gave me an article about this old Zen monastery in California. It was built in 1967. And they said that they went to visit it, but they met somebody at the bottom of the hill there because somebody was going trekking up this path of this very beautiful part of California, and they were sick. And all these cars were passing them, going up to the monastery to do a meditation retreat. And they were trying to flag them down because their child was sick, and not one of them would stop. Well, then, gee, what type of meditation is that? So this man wrote an article in the Straits Times of Singapore, and I got a copy of it. And he said, "I know in Zen, they have a saying in Zen, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him." And he said, "No, that's not right. If you meet the Buddha on the road, give him a lift." In other words, be compassionate to people and kind to people instead of being hard and harsh. And that was one of the wonderful things which, I saw and I learned from those times. And one of the wonderful teachings which I found, which really informed me about what Buddhism really is and the training of the heart, which makes you wise, compassionate, and peaceful, because we're not born peaceful, are we? As soon as we come out of the womb, we start crying, and we cry ever since. I know that as my personal experience, especially on the plane this morning coming from back to Singapore. All these babies were crying. Gee, if I hadn't got my meditation together, I'd go crazy. I became a monk to have a peaceful life, and all this crazy, crying. But, which shows you, it proves that you're not born peaceful. And also, you know, when you're young, you're very self-centered. You're not born compassionate. These are things which we learn. And that learning doesn't stop at school. In fact, you know, some of the stuff you learn at school is not going to help you at all. Well, it may help you get a job, but not help you with life. But certainly, you come to places like this and you learn how to be peaceful. You learn how to be kind. And one of these stories is, I went to go and visit some of these great monks in Thailand. It's not just my own teacher, Ajahn Chah. I once went to go and see one of the other great forest teachers. This was Ajahn Mahabua. And the one teaching which I got from him, I was only staying with him for 6 days, was a great teaching. He once told me that when he was a very young monk, like many monks in the forests of Thailand, he got malaria. It was like just par for the course, what you get when you're a monk living in the jungle. But he decided to fight his malaria, you know, to be a tough guy. Okay, it's just the body. The mind is more powerful than the body. So when it came for the afternoon chores, the monks didn't work all that much. They went on a walk for alms in the morning and just do a little bit of chores in the monastery in the afternoon for half an hour. So when it came for the chores time, even though he had a fever and was really sort of weak, he decided, no, I am also going to do the chores. So he got up there, and even though he was staggering and shaking, he would sweep and sweep and sweep just to show that the mind is more powerful than the body. But the teacher over there was an Ajahn Mun, and he called a meeting that night to tell this monk off. He said, that's not what Buddhism is. You don't fight these fevers. You investigate them. You get to understand them, not fighting and controlling. And that was this talk which he gave that evening, teaching that what Buddhism is, you don't fight and control life, you understand it. Because in the understanding of it, that's where you get your freedom from. Not by fighting. Because you can't fight your body. You can't conquer it. Now, I would love to be thin. I got all this criticism by my fellow monks saying, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you're putting on weight. And I said, no. I am a carbon sink. I am doing my bit for global warming. Because when you take in more carbohydrates, you are actually taking the carbon from the atmosphere. Thereby, you are carbon sink. So anyone else who's overweight, remember, you are global warming, you are helping out. All you thin people, you should take in more carbon so to, you know, to get out of the atmosphere. I've always got an excuse. But just talking with, sometimes you can't control your body. It gets sick. It hurts. And this is one of the great teachings, which I read in the books, but then you see it being practiced. Now people are living it. Okay, you try and look after your body as best you can. But you know what happens. It gets older. And when it gets older, it gets uglier. It gets smellier. It's falling apart. It's decaying. So we've got many decaying Buddhists here this evening. Isn't it great being a Buddhist? You can actually say such things and get away with it. The nice thing about it is just to let it happen instead of trying to fight it. Instead, we understand it. When we understand these things, it gives us an enormous sense of freedom. Because staying with, you know, these people, that again, what you read in the books, again, they were really practicing. No, because they were living a simple life. It was a revelation, because we always say that, you know, as human beings in this age, we should try and have less possessions and live more simply and be more peaceful and kind. What do you really need to be happy? You don't need that much. We don't need that much. It means you don't have to work so hard. When you don't have to work so hard, you get less stress. You've got more time for each other. But we work so hard these days. I don't know how many people complain about stress and how many hours you have to work and how intense you have to work and how you have to struggle to keep up with the latest whatever it is and how to compete for the promotions. And I tell people even these days, what do you want a promotion for? You're crazy if you want a promotion. It just means more stress. Haven't you got enough stress already? People think the promotion is giving them more status. It's not status, it's stress. And you get a bit more money, but that's just a bribe to make you work harder. So I say, no, stop the promotions. Now, I was very unlucky as a monk because I had this really nice setup because for many years I was number two monk. A number two monk is really, really nice. Because you've got someone else in front of you, like, you know, on the convoy. The car in front takes all the wind and all the bugs and everything else. So I was nicely tailgating another monk, and then he just disrobed and let me in it. All my plans went wrong. But just showed me you can't sort of plan anything. It's just life just happens. And this, again, was what we were taught. You know, that sometimes... And this was true. In that life which I had under a teacher like Ajahn Chah, you were happy staying in a monastery. And then he'll come up to you and say, oh, I'm going to send you to the other part of Thailand. I say, well, next week? He said, no, half an hour, get packed. You never knew what was going to happen next. And of course, the teacher did that on purpose, actually to keep you in the present moment. Because all your plans and what you had to do, he just wouldn't let you get away with that. I remembered one story when I told this to some of the other monks when I was over there a couple of days ago. A good sense of what, like, wisdom in action truly is. Because one of our monks, some of you may remember him, he visited here some time ago, Anando his name was. Now he was in the Vietnam War, and he's a Marine, and he got shot in the back of the head. He had like a depression in the back of his head. Unfortunately, that after some years, he developed a tumour and he died from it. But this was 35 years ago, and we just started a new monastery for the Westerners. Again, it was very wise of our teaching. Not only taught us Buddhism and meditation, he also taught us how to run monasteries by actually saying, here's some land, you go off there and learn how to run it by yourself. I'm next door to fix things up, but you learn by experience. So I was one of the first six monks to go to this monastery. It's Wat Nana Chat. And this other monk, Ananda, he asked if he could go over there as well. And I remember Ajahn Chah. And you would go and ask the teacher, Ajahn Chah, and he said, why do you want to go over to that monastery for? He said, because I want to help build this new monastery. He said, no, you can't go. But he really wanted to go, so he asked the second time. I said, I want to go over to this new monastery. What do you want to go for? He said, I think it's very simple. It'd be a very good practice for me, you know, living on the simplicity. Because we slept on the ground. There was no huts or anything. And this was jungle, forest. I still remember very clearly just meditating there and seeing the snakes slither by. I was very fortunate. I didn't know what one snake from another. And I was just hoping that wasn't a dangerous one. It was only later on that somebody told me 100 species of snake in Thailand, 99 are venomous. And the other one strangles you to death. They're all dangerous. You just watch them, you know, slither by just in front of you. And you're meditating there, or sometimes at night you'd be laying down and they just slither past you. Fortunately, they never slithered. Actually, sometimes they did slither up you. I remember this wonderful occasion. We were doing some chanting. And the monk was doing the chanting. It was another monk. The monk sitting next to me. He saw a snake come up his back. Go all the way up his back. When he caught the snake, got up to here. The snake turned around. And the monk turned around. I remember it's one of the most wonderful memories I have. And the snake and the monk were eyeballing each other. But And so the monk just gently pushed his robe down and the snake slithered away. Because the snakes were friendly. They were Buddhist snakes in China. They're very respectful of monks. But anyway, you know, he went another day to see Ajahn Chah. Well, Ajahn Chah said, no, you know, you can't go and stay there. He said again, why do you want to go there? And he said, oh, you know, I think that it would be very good meditation there because it was a cremation ground. There's lots of ghosts there. And Ajahn Chah said, no. And he had all his excuses for going there. One day, this monk, Ananda, he said, I want to go to this new monastery. Why do you want to go out there? He said, because I just want to hang out with my other Western friends. Okay, you can go. That's true. That happened. Because we wanted honesty. It didn't matter that you had your desires and you wanted things. The most important thing was being honest and truthful to yourself. And these great monks, you know, they did read your mind and they knew exactly what you were up to. And of course, they had compassion as well. They understand, okay, you know, being a Westerner over in a foreign country, you like hanging out with your friends, speaking English and just cracking jokes together. But all the teacher wanted was honesty. Not only honesty, but patience. Because I remember another story, again, my predecessor, Ajahn Jacquo, after being there for 1 year, Ajahn Chah was sending this monk, Jacquo, off to another monastery. And so he told me, oh, I'm going off to this monastery. It's called Suan Glui, like banana plantation monastery. And he said, I'm going there. And then he went up to, after 2 or 3 days, he hadn't heard anything, so he went to see Ajahn Chah. He said, when am I going? And Ajahn said, oh, I'm not sure yet. And he went another day. When am I going? Oh, not sure yet. And I remember Ajahn Jacquo talking to me. He said, I don't know what Ajahn Chah's up to. I keep on asking him when I'm going, and he won't tell me. So one night, he went actually night after night asking when he was going to go. And the one night, he never went. The next night, Ajahn Chah sent him. He says he was impatient. He wanted to know what the future's going to be. And this is a sign of what Buddhism is in practice. We just adapt to whatever happens. Because how many of you have had plans for the future which haven't turned out exactly the way you wanted? Actually, all of you, and it happens every day. This is what the future is. The future is something else other than you think it's going to be. It's one of the great sayings of the Buddha in the Buddhist scriptures. Whatever you think it's going to be, it would always be something different. When I heard teachings like that, I thought, wow, that's great teaching. That's very deep. Whatever you expect it's going to be, it will always be different than that. When you really get your mind around that, what it means is, what on earth are we spending all this time, wasting all this time, anticipating, thinking and planning when it all goes wrong? But it's not like that. And so in these training monasteries where we were always kept on our toes in the present moment, not having to plan our future. We didn't know what was going to happen next. You know, that was incredibly freeing, peaceful, and created much more happiness in your life when you didn't actually plan, you know, your week's activities of what you're going to do, when you're going to do it, and how you're going to do it. When you become more adaptive, you know, to life as it happens, rather than always trying to fix it. Because you know what happens when your plans get frustrated, when it doesn't work out as you expect, you get angry. And a lot of anger comes from that, from frustrated plans. And one great way of overcoming anger is not having any plans. No expectations. Of course, you can't do that 100%, but at least the less plans, the less expectations you have, the less anger you have, the less frustrated. You're not fighting life. You're not trying to make life fit into your schedule. You're becoming more adaptive. And again, that's the sort of things which we learned. Not just simplicity in material things. We didn't have hardly anything. Now, literally, you know, sometimes, again, didn't have any shoes. Now, that you think that's okay. You know, even these days, you know, people in the hot weather, and maybe go down the beach, they don't wear shoes. But this is Perth. Imagine not wearing shoes when there's all these creepy crawlies about. Not just snakes, centipedes, scorpions, and many other things I didn't know the name of, but they considered you as their dinner. There were these ants, and I saw them again. My old friends, they're called, you know, the Motlin, the black biting ants. And they pack a punch. If you step in them, when they bite you, you jump. I remember once, again at night time, going back from the evening meeting in a dark, dangerous jungle. And you stepped on them because you didn't have any shoes. I had a flashlight. But I jumped one way, my flashlight jumped another way. Oh, that was very dangerous. There I was, stuck in the jungle. These ants were all around. And I didn't have a flashlight. It was in the bush somewhere. So, there were very dangerous times, but I never expected anything. You always managed to find your way back to your hut somehow or other. But what it was teaching you was, doesn't matter, don't worry about such things. It'll all be okay. Life in the present moment with no expectations. And what are you worried for anyway? The one time I was actually very healthy as a young monk in Thailand. I think maybe because my attitude was always really positive. But one of the, the first bit of positivity which I learned from my teacher, I first went to Thailand, you know, when I was 23, and I got up to see Ajahn Chah. It was only, 74. That's about right. It's January 74. And it was just his mother had just passed away. They were preparing a funeral service for her. And for some reason, Ajahn Chah decided to make a mountain made out of bamboo baskets covered with papier-mâché. I don't know why he was doing that. It made no sense to me. But I, like everybody else, joined in making these little baskets out of bamboo. I remember it was very difficult to do, because I was a theoretical physicist. I wasn't good with my hands. I remember my first experience with the teacher. He came up to me and told me, "Oh, your basket's very beautiful." And I looked at him, and I looked at other people's baskets, and I say, "What are you talking about? It's a mess." But this was the beginning of the attitude. It doesn't matter if it's a mess. Praise gets you everywhere. That little bit of praise, you know, got me as a disciple. So remember, if you're going out, sometimes some of you might bring your girlfriend or boyfriend here. If you want them to like you, praise them. Say, "What a great guy you are. Oh, what a lovely, charming girl you are." It's amazing how much more traction you will get in life when you praise your partner more. And it's basic Buddhism. Flattery gets you everywhere. It's positive reinforcement. And it's not just praising your partner. It's what we call like the perception of the beautiful, of the positive. It's the opposite of the fault-finding mind. And this was my first experience of that. If Ajahn Chah was a Western monk, he'd have probably said, "That's a terrible basket you're doing there. Gee, where were you brought up? Can't you even weave a basket? What do they teach you in the West? You hopeless scallywag, hopeless..." That's sometimes the sort of thing we say in the West. We criticize each other when we make mistakes. But how does that feel when you're criticized? When I got the praise, I realized this was a different type of environment, a different culture. Outside of monasteries in Thailand, they're still criticized, but in the monasteries, you were built up and praised. You were valued. It was compassion. But it was a compassion on a very, very deep level, because it was actually encouraging you to be at peace with yourself. And actually, the next basket I made was even better, because, you know, once you get praised by the teacher, you want to show off and live up to that praise. You see what happens when you praise somebody and you encourage them? So I should, if you've got kids, always encourage them. Doesn't matter what they did in the, you know, the TE scores. At least they didn't come bottom. At least they got some marks. What's the bottom mark in the TE? Is it zero? Can anyone get zero? At least you didn't get zero. You got one mark or two marks. Whatever. encourage, because when you encourage somebody, you build them up and actually they do better next time. And that's what I learned. It wasn't any of this criticism business, it was encouragement all the time. Even during the chanting, some of our chanting was hopeless. We had to learn all these chants, you know, the sort of the stuff, the rituals of Buddhism. And sometimes it's very difficult to do those chants. So again, Ajahn Chah would take compassion on us. He said, look, doesn't matter when you go in front of all those lay people, we're doing this chanting. He said, just open your mouth up and down, up and down, up and down, and no one will know that you're not chanting. That's what he said. That was really compassionate to us. But it wasn't just compassion. He would give us heaps and heaps of wisdom. And I just, where was it? On Wednesday morning, I walked over from Wat Nanachat to Wat Bapong, and I went past an area when I would go on alms round, and very often I'd go on the same route where Ajahn Chah went on. And I remember him, the place, because you get all these nostalgic memories when you go and visit the place where you grew up as a monk. I remember the place, you know, where he stopped, and he picked up a stick from the side of the road. And he turned around and said, you know, Bama Wangso, because that's my name. The full name is Bama Wangso. Ajahn Brahm is only the shortened version. Bama Wangso, how heavy is this stick? And before I could answer, he threw it away in the bush. He said, see, it's only heavy when you attach to it. And there's simple teachings like that, which you got all the time from these great monks. So it's easy to say, oh, you shouldn't be attached. You know, you shouldn't grasp onto things and hold things. It should be simple. But he's showing why. In a very simple teaching, that if you hold on to something for too long, it gets heavy. That is why you suffer. So how many of you have felt grief when somebody dies? Okay, you can feel sad when somebody close to you dies, but why do you hold on to it for so long? Okay, pick up the stick of grief and throw it in the forest as soon as you can. Then it's not heavy. Then you don't suffer so much. It's because we hold on to things too long is why we suffer. Or what somebody said to us. See, I don't know how many people just worry about what he said to me. And when did he say it? Oh, 5 years ago? Oh, come on. Can't you let that one go? If it was this morning, fair enough, you know, just give him a hard time for a day. But, you know, by this evening, okay, enough now. Why do we always hold on to the past for ages and ages and ages? In Buddhism, that's absolutely stupid. Good example of that was the Cambodian community. What they went through during the Killing Fields years. And obviously, because most of the Cambodians are Buddhists, the ones over here you get to know very well, known for 25 years. And they've got no hatred for what happened in the past. They've let it go. You know, one of the most beautiful ceremonies I saw, this was not from Thailand, this is over here, a letting go ceremony. One of these, the men, one of the leaders of the Cambodian community here in Perth, he's actually retired now, he's quite old. He was a monk before. But he was forced to disrobe by the Khmer Rouge when the Khmer Rouge took over Cambodia. It was actually death or just disrobe. So he chose to disrobe. I mean, he got married and lived in a commune. But he was one of the people, like in that, for those of you who remember the film Killing Fields, who escaped from the commune, went through the jungles, and got over the border into Thailand with his wife. He made it into safety. However, during that journey, his wife contracted malaria and died in the camp. It's such a sad thing because it almost got to freedom. And just, you know, they were in Thailand, they were outside of the country, but his wife had brought malaria with her, you know, trekking through the jungles, and it was too far gone, and she died. Now, this was a refugee who'd lost everything. There's no way he could organize a funeral or do any services for her. So he just put it aside for a while. Eventually he was resettled with many other Cambodians here in Perth. And after 2 or 3 years in Perth, he invited me and some other monks for a ceremony in his house. It was in Bentley, in one of the units up there. And where we were doing the chanting, quite unexpectedly, he came to the front, and from his shirt pocket he took out a photograph. It was dog-eared and creased, and I saw it. It was the only picture he had of his wife in Cambodia who died in the camp. He had already remarried here in Perth, and his present wife was standing behind, letting him do this. He took out the picture, put it in front of him, put his hands up, and while the monks were chanting, he cried his eyes out. He wept. This was how he hadn't had time to deal with his grief over 2 or 3 years. Now this was his chance. The monks were there, we were chanting. The chanting only lasted for about 15 minutes. When we finished the chanting, he wiped his eyes, stopped the crying, put the photograph back into his pocket, and joined in the ceremonies, happy and free. It was one of the most beautiful ceremonies of how we deal with these things. We don't just hold the stick all the time. You know, he couldn't throw it away straight away because he had the trouble of being a penniless refugee trying to find a new life. The first opportunity, he threw that stick away in a beautiful way, in a wonderful ceremony. And that's what the sort of thing which Ajahn Chah would teach us, not to keep things. Even one of the most famous stories, which, because I was there at the time, is one of the great stories in the book. And, you know, the book Open the Door of Your Heart has been translated to many languages, including Thai. When I was over there, the publishers in the Thai translations, and over 100,000 copies have been printed in Thailand. And one of the monks over there, you know, he sort of commented to me about this story, which is why it's in the front of my mind. And it's the story of the three Western monks. It was myself, it was a novice called Gary, and there was the translator, whose name was Prabhakaro. And Ajahn Chah was in a passenger seat, and as a driver, we'd been taken to the railway station from the monastery. And that was when Ajahn Chah turned around in the car, and he looked at this. He looked at this novice, Gary, he was from New Mexico, and he said to him, "You're thinking about your girlfriend." It's very dangerous to be in a car with a monk who has psychic powers. Because he'd read this young novice's mind. He was thinking about his girlfriend. And this poor, I can always remember the face, this poor novice, Gary, his face went white, his jaw dropped. Really embarrassing having your mind read in public. But then Ajahn Chah said something else. He said, we can fix that. And he said, next time you write to your girlfriend back in the United States, ask her to send something of hers, something personal. So when you miss her, you can take that out and it reminds you of her. And then he replies through the translator, "Is that allowable? Now, is that okay for a monk to have things like that? You know, sort of keepsakes of your girlfriend in case you feel lonely?" And that's, "Oh, yeah, 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 you can do that." And this poor novice thought, "Oh, even great teachers are romantic." And no, he wasn't. Because what Ajahn Chah said, so the interpreter, it took a long time to translate it because he was kidding himself laughing. He said, next time you write to your girlfriend back in the States, ask her to send you a bottle, a small bottle of her shit. So the next time you miss her, take out the shit and say, "Oh, that's my girlfriend." Ah. Because it is very personal, isn't it? You can't get more personal than that. And that was actually the great teachers, Ajahn Chah. That's what I got all the time from these people. And these were teachings which were funny. You will never forget them. And they really helped. So look, I mean, when you fall in love, what do you fall in love with anyway? How many people say, "Oh, I love her. I love all of her. Every bit of it. Not just, you know, love is more than skin deep." Yes. So that way, we're not loving a body, we're loving a person. This is much better because bodies change. So Ajahn Chah was teaching us how to really let go of things. And this was why it was not sort of just a Buddhism of theory. It was not just like going to a lecture You know what it's like at school or university or college? You listen to lectures and say, these are the sorts of things you have to learn. And it's all just book knowledge and it's just theory. But the training which you got in these places were not theory. It was actually living practice. And sometimes you thought, wow, if the Buddha was alive, this is probably how he would have taught. You know, taking these problems of life, the things which stop you being free, which stop you being happy. All these things we worry about, like the grief, or like the, even like the status. There was, somebody reminded me of this story, which I haven't told here, that there was one of Ajahn Chah's old disciples. One of the people from town had helped him for so many years, and this man had been elected into the government as an MP. And so he went to go to Ajahn Chah to say, look, I'm an MP now, give us a blessing, because it's a celebration. Can you also celebrate, the fact that I've won in an election? And so when he saw the monk, Ajahn Chah was up in his room, he saw the monk downstairs, oh, can you come and call Ajahn Chah? And he sort of gave him his card, MP so-and-so. And then the monk took that card up to see Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah sent the message down, I don't know this guy. What do you mean you don't know this guy? So I've been with Ajahn Chah for years. But then the disciple got an idea. And so he crossed out the front of the card, and on the back of the card he just gave his ordinary name and sent that up. And Ajahn Chah said, oh, it came down, oh, it's nice to see you. What he was teaching there, he says, outside of a monastery, yes, status counts. But inside of a monastery, no status. Everybody, man, woman, rich, sort of, or poor, whether you're high society or low society, he doesn't care. He will judge everybody individually, personally. And he always did that, and that was wonderful to see. Outside of a monastery, okay, we have the status. We have the business people, the rich people, people from big families, royalty, generals, or whatever. But inside a monastery, because everybody was equal, and that was wonderful to see. One of my wonderful memories of being in Thailand, after coming over here to Australia for about 4 or 5 years, I went back to visit Thailand. And of course, when I went back to visit Thailand and visit this old monastery where I grew up for 9 years, all these villagers in this little village there, they supported me. I was actually one of them. I was family. And the first time, because you arrive in the afternoon, go straight into the monastery, the first time the villagers see you is on the morning alms round, when all the monks go in file, silently, to collect their alms food. And when I went that first morning, a few people looked up. Oh, Ajahn Brahm. They started crying. They were weeping because it was somebody they knew would come back to their village again. And that really moved me, just you were really part of their village. There's only one of the old people left now. I remember him telling me on Thursday morning, he said, all the other people, the old ones are gone, all new people now. Poor Son. It was really nice to see. These are like your old friends, even though they're Thais. Even one of the old men there, he's featured in one of the movies about Ajahn Chah. Because he was an old friend, when I went back one time, he was dying. So I went to see him in his home, because he couldn't come to the monastery, and started talking to him in Lao. We were talking about the old times, and he used to be the herbal doctor in the area. And he actually learned that his story was, he was a fisherman, and he asked Ajahn Chah, he said, look, I've got a lot of faith in Buddhism, but, I have to catch fish. And that's what you have to do. When I was first in Thailand, people told me that in Thailand, how can you catch fish if you're keeping 5 precepts as a Buddhist? You're not supposed to kill anything. And one of the Thai people in Bangkok said, oh, it's okay, because here in Thailand, we don't kill the fish. We just take them out of the water and they die by themselves. That doesn't make sense to me, but that's what they told me. But anyway, this young villager, he was a fisherman. He said, look, I need to fish to feed my family. And again, the teachings of Buddhism are always very practical. This monk said, okay, This is Ajahn Chah. He said, catch fish. He told him, you know, you can't keep your five precepts. You've got to look after your family. This is compassion for not just fish, but for your family as well. Catch those fish, but only enough to feed your family and yourself, but not for making any more money. Don't sell them. He said, at the same time, Ajahn Chah, like many of the forest monks, they had to learn about the plants around them because of the medicinal qualities in there. Every monk would actually learn about the plants and their, how they could be used. He became like a herbal doctor. All those old forest monks became herbalists. And Ajahn Chah knew about what type of plant fixed what problem. And so he taught this to this man so he could have another career. And little by little, as he got to know herbal medicine from the plants and the roots in the area, he never needed to fish anymore. He got his income from this. And I was talking to him just before he died, and I remember one thing he said was just really remarkable. He said, oh, I've been living here for such a long time, and I'm the herbal doctor. One thing I've noticed, he said, you know, before they had the hospital in town, people were so much more healthy. And now they have the hospital, everyone gets sick. That's what he told me. It's fascinating. The connection between building hospitals and having more sickness. The nature of the mind is so powerful. Sure, there are sicknesses, but sometimes the more doctors we have, maybe the more sickness we have. What do you reckon? Well, that's actually what he saw from a guy who'd been in the air for such a long time. But anyway, that when you actually see how these things were teaching, when I got sick in hospital, Ajahn Chah came to see me this one time. I know you've heard this story before, but this is Ajahn Chah's story, and it's teaching. This is actually what you learn and how you learn Buddhism. Again, not from theory, but these experiences, they really sort of free you. Because I had typhus fever. We never knew what it was at the time, because in this particular monastery, where we'd actually sleep on the ground, which we often used to do outside of our huts, to practice being simple monks, there were these little mites, small insects on the ground, which carry typhus fever, scrub typhus. And because all the local people in the area had developed immunity over the generations, it's only when the Westerners, the foreigners, came into the country, we were the ones who got typhus fever. And so the town doctors, they never thought it existed in that part of the world. Later on, it was actually found out, yeah, there was typhus there. So when I got my typhus fever, went into a hospital, and you really feel sick, very sick. I was a very healthy, fit young man. I got so sick and felt so terrible and really quite depressed, a long way from home. That was the time when first evening was in this hospital with a drip in my arm, feeling like death. And at 6 p.m., it was in the monk's ward, about a dozen beds, with a nurse having their desk at the front of the ward. The nurse, a male nurse, left. And by 7, 8 o'clock, the replacement nurse hadn't come in. So I asked the monk sitting next to me, you know, in my broken tie, when is the replacement nurse coming? Should we tell someone they haven't turned up? And the monk next to me said, what do you mean, night nurse? There is no night nurse. We only have a nurse during the day. And if something goes wrong at night time, it's just bad karma. You know, that never really helped. I was terrified. So that was the situation you were in, third world country, third world hospital, and you were very sick, and you felt depressed and weak. And then Ajahn Chah came into the ward just to see me. But even by then, there was this great big monk, you know, your hero and teacher, and he came all the way just to see me. And as soon as I saw him walk in the ward towards me, you felt so uplifted. It's great having visits like that in the hospital because it just gives you builds up your morale. You feel good that someone actually cares for you and likes you, has come all this way to visit you. And he came right by my bedside and I didn't feel sick at all for about a minute. And that's what he told me. This is the teachings you get when you're sick. He said, Ajahn Brahm, he didn't say Ajahn then, he said, Brahmawangsa, you'll either get better or you'll die. And then he walked out. Thank you very much. Great teacher. But it was a great teaching. Because, you know, afterwards you think about that. How can you find fault with that? My problem was I didn't like feeling sick. Because, you know, being sick doesn't feel nice at all. It's painful. It's just humiliating sometimes. But it doesn't matter. Remember, the next time you're sick, it won't last. You'll either get better or you'll die. Either way, the sickness won't last. What a brilliant teaching that is. Because why is it when you're sick, you get upset? You can't stand the pain, the sickness, the weakness. Isn't it nice to know it won't last? You will die. So those are the sorts of wisdom teachings you've gotten. So straight away, when you had a sickness, you remember now it's only body, you're going to die anyway. Might as well get it over and done with as soon as possible. Well, you are going to die anyway, aren't you? Do you really want to die when you're old age? Have you ever been to old age homes? Gee, it's not very nice sometimes. So why don't you say when you get to be 60 and you've got cancer, oh, whoopee. I don't have to go to old people's home. We've got a really weird idea about life and death. But of course, in Buddhist countries, because we believe in reincarnation or rebirth and karma, just really Buddhists shouldn't be afraid of death. And that's one of the other things I learned by staying in these places. Whenever anybody died, we would actually have the funeral out in the open. There's a cheap box, cheap wood. They would put the corpse inside. And the villagers would collect the wood from the forest and put it into a pyre, and put the coffin on top and burn it right there. But before they burned it, all the monks would go up and have a look. It was a wonderful thing to do, to see a real dead body. And this was not an embalmed body. Over here in Australia, now before you can see it, it's been embalmed. These guys in the funeral parlour, or girls, they inject it with so many chemicals, they make sure the mouth is smiling and they look peaceful. How many times when you go and see a loved one, do you say, oh, they look so peaceful? It's just a dead body. The dead body's not peaceful. That's just the skill of the undertaker. If you see a real dead body, they look grey. No colour in them at all. And mostly the mouth is open. But, because of funeral directors, they just do that to make you feel good. But sometimes just making you feel good is actually taking away the truth, the reality of these things. So, because people couldn't afford these things, it was just no reality. You really saw dead bodies. And they never looked like what I see these days when I go to funeral services. And it was great. You could touch it and be with it and realise, you know, one day you'll be the same. You know, it wasn't scary at all. It was actually liberating. Truth, reality, is never scary when you really understand it. It's the other thing which causes the problems. You know, the fantasies, the dreams, the lack of reality in our life. When we face death, it's a relief in a sense. Because our old body, we don't want to keep this body going for too long, and it's a release. So, when you actually see these, and also you've also learned about, you know, how to actually do a cremation, because sometimes, I don't know if you know this, but over in those cremations, they always put the body on the side if it's going to be one of these open-air cremations. And I always saw these villagers, they'd always make sure that the body was on its side, but sometimes it actually would, because of its open fire, turn on its back. And then you realise why, you'd never burn anybody on their back. Because this is the nature, the heat and the muscles. Something contracts, something expands because of the muscles being burnt. And I saw once the body lying on its back because the muscles contracting. Sit up. Not only sit up, but the right arm lifted up too. And a finger came out. They don't want to do that. It's very spooky. It's only nature. But that's what happens. And so these are actually, you know, what you were dealing with as a young monk. So you're really right up there, face to face with old age, sickness and death. Sometimes people think, oh, you monks, you just live you're not in the real world. You know, you don't have to go to, you don't have to face the things which we have to face. But a lot of times, as a monk, you see things which no one else can see. You're not allowed to see it. So you see a lot of really fascinating and interesting truths about the nature of life. You know, we don't just do sort of, marriages and funerals. You know, I was saying in sort of Thailand, we do all these marriage ceremonies. I think we should start a Buddhist divorce ceremony as well. Because, you know, when you have the marriage ceremonies, you know, the two people go up there together and they make their vows and they exchange rings. And they say just, you know, how much I love you and I will love you forever, my darling. We can do a divorce ceremony as well, Buddhist divorce ceremony. The two of them get up there together and they say, I hate your guts. I don't know why I ever married you. And instead of exchanging rings, they can throw things each other. Now, I don't think a Buddhist divorce ceremony would ever have much weight. It's a rite of passage, isn't it, I suppose? But anyhow, these are the things which you learn from Thailand as those monks. So it was actually real Buddhism. Actually, and you saw that people who lasted the course, now the monks who stayed there for a long time, when you were seeing this, you became so detached from the world, but still have lots of compassion. You know, sickness, and either you get better or you die, you didn't worry about it, which is one of the reasons why you got a lot better. In any sickness, it's the mental stuff, the worry, that's the big killer. It's the same these days when people do get a cancer. You know, you've heard me say this here before, I say enjoy your cancer. Now that's not just, you know, being flippant. By changing your attitude to the disease which you have, you're giving yourself an increased chance of survival. Just attitude is half the problem. No, I'd say more than half the problem. And so this is what I've learned over there, maybe because of those attitudes, not the fault-finding and the worrying mind, worrying about what might happen in the future. Who knows what might happen in the future? Whatever you expect it to be, it'll be different. So because you learn how to let go, you didn't carry your cancer around or your divorce around or whatever, you threw things away very quickly. You saw that, you practiced that, you learned that, you did that. And so going through this training, you see, it wasn't just sitting on your cushion, on your butt, meditating all day. It was just learning from the lifestyle. Now, I should actually mention the arms round, because when I first did the arms round, I was really embarrassed. Because I came from a rich country. And there I was, a monk with a big degree, coming from a rich country, begging for food from these people who were dirt poor, subsistence farmers. I felt very guilty at first. How can I receive food from these people? I should be going back to England and working and sending them donations and money. And then one day we were invited to a house to get our food. So we did go on arms round that morning. And that afternoon, the headman of the village came to see us to apologize. And I couldn't understand this. What are you apologizing for that we didn't come on arms round? You'll have more food today. You should be happy. Oh, those beggar monks haven't come today. But they were really upset that we never went to their village to receive food that day. That's when I started to understand what this alms food is all about, what generosity is all about. It's not that I needed to accept their food, or they really needed to give. And that just opened just a huge wisdom about giving and receiving. As a monk, yesterday morning in Bangkok airport, yesterday evening rather, this woman gave me some new shoes. They were terrible shoes. I hope she's not listening to this, by the way, in Bangkok. Oh, maybe I've already done it now, so I'm in trouble. She gave me these terrible new shoes. And of course, my last comfortable shoes, so I put away and I wore her shoes in the airport. And she was so happy I wore her shoes. Of course, as soon as I got to Singapore, I took them off and wore my old ones. But this is how what I learned. It's not that I need shoes. Many of you would say, I've already got a good pair of shoes. I don't need yours. Take them away. I never do that. Because she needed to give it to me. And I needed to make her happy. And that's what he learned. The whole alms food business. The reason why monks, we've got no money. We can't handle money. Now we can't keep food. We can't cook food. We are
deliberately, intentionally dependent. I don't know how many people want to be independent, self-sufficient. I don't need anyone in this world. It's a terrible world to live in. Being independent, self-sufficient. I don't need anybody. The Buddha told his monks, you have to be dependent. Completely. I can't eat tomorrow morning without somebody coming to give me some food. Even the clothes I wear are given. Everything I have is given. This is a beautiful tradition. What it means is connecting with another person. Please understand that if anybody, especially your loved ones, if they give you something, even if you don't want it, please accept it, because it's respecting. Someone has gone out of their way to actually offer you a present. Please respect the gift, or rather the attitude, the thought behind the gift, and accept it, and wear it, even if it's only just for one day. When they come back and see you again, take it out of the cupboard and wear it again. Make them happy. When I understood about what generosity was, as a Westerner, I never understood that before. I always thought, you know, generosity meant, the orphanage needed something, you give it to them. I always thought it's because they needed it. I never understood that generosity was I, as a human being, need to give to others. And these days, because I've got no money to give, I just give my life. Going around all over the world, teaching this and teaching that, working my butt off and getting really tired, but I don't care, I have good fun. Because even though you really give. I know what it's like. Even at the airport in Bangkok, I saw a couple of copies of my book on sale. I went into the bookshop and there's a couple of copies of my book on sale. And then the guy saw me looking at it and recognized me and said, oh, would you sign his books? And I thought, gee, everywhere I go I have to sign books, my poor hand. Even coming back here this evening I have to sign books. But I don't mind. It's just my way of being able to give something. Oh, look, I just come back from a long trip overseas. Friday night, I had to go and give a talk. No, I enjoy this because it's my way of giving. It's not that you need to listen to a talk or someone else, that I need to give. It's part of being a human being. So these are the things which I learned. Compassion, what real generosity is. And how to accept gifts. And how to be dependent. How to form these relationships with other people. Through giving and receiving, knowing how to do that properly. Another positive reinforcement. That's a beautiful basket you've made there. Even though it doesn't matter, I'll be truthful. He was lying. It was a terrible basket. But he did that just to give a bit of praise and encouragement. And it works. And just not attaching to things, not worrying about the future or the past. It's all gone. Learning how to forgive, not worrying about old age, sickness and death. Isn't this beautiful freeing? We talk about detaching and having no craving and being peaceful, being kind. This was actually in action. And so you lived in these monasteries and people were just living that life. And that was the most inspiring thing of all. You can read about it, you can discuss it, you can write essays about it. But seeing it actually practiced and lived. That's the most inspiring thing of all. And the last story, because I'm going over time now. The most impressive memory I've ever will have of my teacher, Ajahn Chah. I'm going to tell two stories. Hope you don't mind. Just at the last, when he became famous, all these famous people started visiting him and giving him things. And he'd always received them, because this is what generosity is. I remember when this Thai general came to see him. You all know, I don't know if they formed a new government yet in Thailand, but there was a military coup. The generals in Thailand have always had a lot of power. And this was a time when they had absolute power. You know, there's always military people running the governments. So this general came to see Ajahn Chah for a blessing. I was there, and you know, this Ajahn Chah was sitting on his seat, and this big general, and had all his other military people were there in the back, all his offsiders, lieutenant generals or majors or whatever. A whole convoy came into the monastery. This general came up, he said, can I have a blessing, can I have some holy water? Blessing. And Ajahn Chah didn't have any holy water. He said, don't mind, come over here. And this guy bent in front of him, and Ajahn Chah spat on his hair. and rubbed it in.
And I was sitting, I thought, oh no, Ajahn Chah, he's gone over the top this time.
You can't get away with this. He did. He rubbed it in. And the Tajan, oh, sadhu, 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 sadhu. How can you get more holy water than Ajahn Chah's own spit?
He's a joker, Ajahn Chah. It's great to be around because I always kept you on your toes.
And this was actually the rituals of holy water in that monastery. But then anyway,
this one last story, Ajahn Chah asked me to go up to his room. And he'd only ever allow just, I think, usually the one monk who looked after him, to ever go up to his room. And he asked me to go up there to get something. I always remember this. I was so excited. At last, I can go and see how my teacher lives. I've seen him in action. I've seen his teachings. You want to actually see how he lives. No. In public, some people are one way, but in private, they're another person. And when I went up into his room, I almost cried. There's nothing there. There was a mat, a grass mat, a wooden pillow, one robe or something on the line. Nothing else. No knickknacks. No sort of pictures on the wall. No photographs. Nothing. And this was a monk at the height of his fame, having all these very wealthy people offering all sorts of stuff. He kept nothing. Now that's the sign of an enlightened person who lives in this world, fully famous, at peace, very beautiful, very kind, very wise. You go and see where they live, and there's nothing there. That's what I remember. Buddhism actually being lived. Aham Sama Sambuddho Bhagavan Buddhang Bhagavan Sanghabhivati Suvakato Bhagavan Sanghabhivati Dhammang Namasana Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho